From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, President Trump has continually praised President Andrew Jackson. One Native American historian says his praises ignore historical facts.
I think that's one thing that we do in history is we try to, you know, sugarcoat it. And I don't sugarcoat it. And I don't feel like I need to, because I feel like history speaks for itself. And the history says Andrew Jackson was not a good man. It hurts my heart. It hurts my spirit when I hear people sing his praises.
Then, following last year's demise of growing power, urban farmer Will Allen reinvents himself, sort of.
And in the 1970s, the fate of the historic Pabst Mansion on West Wisconsin Avenue hung in the balance.
When this house came up for sale, the only person that had the wherewithal to purchase it was the gentleman who owned a hotel next door, and his intention was to tear it down for a parking lot.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Although Native American history predates U.S. history by thousands of years, many history textbooks condense it to just a few paragraphs. For many, the most prominent moments in that history are Thanksgiving and the Trail of Tears, the latter comprising of forced relocations and death marches, which killed thousands of Native people in the 1800s.
But throughout the history of this country, Native people have continued to fight for their rights through legislation and demonstrations. Heather Briegel is a member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin and a historian and lecturer on Native American activism and policies. She was in Milwaukee for a lecture on that topic earlier this fall, and she joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers then.
Heather, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is maybe an odd place to start, but I was really curious, when you first talk to non-Native people especially about your work and what you do, how do they respond?
It kind of usually depends on the type of setting, kind of also helps determine how someone reacts to it. But I do really mainly speak to non-Native people. And when I do start talking about especially topics that are not the most pleasant, there is usually some look of resistance that I can see throughout the audience until they realize that I'm not really just attacking non-Native people. I'm just really here to educate you about a certain event or situation. And then the reaction is more of coming from a place of education where they want to learn more and find out more about whatever they can about the Native people in this country. And then usually at the end of it, it's those people who usually have the looks of resistance that come up to me at the end and are usually like, thank you so much for, you know, talking, thank you, I learned so much, I didn't know this before, I definitely want to find out more information.
Yeah, I mean, you know, personally, there was so much that I really didn't know. What are the kind of misconceptions, misperceptions that you come across when you really start talking to people?
Honestly, legitimately, that we are all the same type of Native when we're really not. We're different. While we're all Indigenous to this country, we are different in our practices, in our language, in our thought processes and feelings. But I think one of the other misconceptions is that I saw this on Facebook actually a while ago, and I thought it was quite funny, but it fit perfectly, that people tend to think of, you know, Indigenous people or Native people, you know, being at one with nature and harmony and, you know, all of the good things. But what they fail to realize is that we are activists as well. We are resisting. We are trying to decolonize. We are trying to embrace our religion again. So while, yes, we do hold nature and Mother Earth sacred, we're out there fighting. And I think that's a big misconception that people don't realize, is that we're out there with you fighting.
That's what so much of your talk is about. When you first start talking about activism, where do you start?
I kind of talk about it in a little bit more of a modern sense, where I talk about the formation of the American Indian Movement in the 1960s. However, one can personally go back farther than that and talk about our activism in sense of like the Indian Wars that happened, you know, when there was fighting that would happen when, you know, the United States was trying to expand westward. You know, say you've got the Great Sioux War, you've got the Black Hawk War, you've got Red Cloud's War, you've got the Battle of Little Bighorn. I mean, these are all acts of resistance because we were resisting colonization. We were resisting settlers coming out west, and we were resisting, you know, the invasion from the people who were discovering gold. So you can go back farther and talk about that. That could take a semester in college. That's how long it could take. But when I talk about it for an audience, I usually start with the more modern civil rights era movement in the 1960s with the formation of the American Indian Movement.
The American Indian Movement is fascinating. And when you talk about AIM and when you talk about the larger movement, I can kind of remember learning about that in high school history class, but it was maybe a few paragraphs in a textbook. It wasn't something that we really dug into the same way that we dug into the civil rights movement, but it did have a similar impact just on the Native American community.
Right, and you have all of these movements happening at such a volatile time in our country. I mean, in the 1960s, you have the overall civil rights movement happening. You have the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You have the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You have, you know, second wave feminism happening. You have the LGBT movement happening and the rise of, you know, Harvey Milk and LGBT rights. You've got AIM, the American Indian Movement happening. You've got, you know, laborers, Chicanos, all of those movements happening at one time. To be personally honest, I don't actually think I remember in high school, now I went to high school in Michigan, but I don't remember hearing anything about the American Indian Movement. It probably wasn't until I got to college, and even then it was maybe just a paragraph or so, like, oh, this was happening too, by the way. But like an afterthought of the main civil rights movement going on.
Yeah, I can remember the image, which is, I think, why I remember it. In my textbook, they had an image of protesters, I believe, on Alcatraz, which you also mentioned in your speech.
Yeah, I think we probably remember the same image.
It's an iconic image, yeah.
Absolutely. And yeah, Alcatraz, I think, wow, they held that for over a year. They held Alcatraz Island for over a year. And that was a culmination of all tribes coming together. It started with 80 people, and at one point, there was well over 200 people on the island. So that was pretty awesome in a way to bring, you know, awareness to the breaking of treaties and land being stolen and wanting an area just for, you know, us to embrace our culture and to be able to really feel like you could be free in a certain area. So, you know, when I first read about Alcatraz, I thought that was fascinating.
I'm speaking with Heather Briegel. She is about to give a lecture over at the Milwaukee Public Museum about Native American activism and policies. And, you know, really, when you get into all of this, it's such a deep history in our country. Where you started, at least in the lecture that I was listening to, was with President Andrew Jackson and the Indian Removal Act and, of course, the Trail of Tears. And I think that's where a lot of people often stop when it comes to Native American history. They stop at this really dreadful death march. Our perceptions around that, at least my perceptions, were that, yes, there was activism. Obviously, there was fighting, but I didn't recognize how much legal activity was going on even then and how much it has continued today.
Yeah, absolutely. When I do talk about policy, I do start with, you know, Andrew Jackson, good old friend to the Native Americans, who was instrumental in basically making sure that there weren't any Native tribes in the southeastern portion of the United States. Thousands of people moved, thousands more died. It was just absolutely ridiculous. And then to find out how through amendments and through bills and through the Constitution, they were able to do all of this stuff and, you know, force us to move. And then what's really, really interesting is when I do talk about policy even more, and even for my own personal education and knowledge, as I was researching things, it didn't dawn on me that Native Americans, we were not considered citizens of the United States until 1924. And I was doing the math, and it dawned on me that my grandfather was 13 before he was considered a citizen of the United States. in the land that he was born in, in the country that he was born in. He wasn't considered a citizen officially until 1924, and that is absolutely insane. So it's no wonder why they were able to, why all these policies and the government were able to get away with things for so long, because they could. We weren't citizens, so they could govern us however they wanted.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about Andrew Jackson closer to the beginning of Donald Trump's presidency, and he has made it very clear that he is a fan of Andrew Jackson. When you hear politicians like Donald Trump, like some people in the GOP, praising President Andrew Jackson, how does that make you feel? What do you think of?
Oh, God. I think it was last year where, it was either last year or earlier this year, to be honest, it's all kind of blending together, but Donald Trump held a ceremony in the White House. I feel like it was in the Oval Office, and he was honoring some Navajo code talkers. And in the background was a portrait of Andrew Jackson. I lost it. I lost my cool. And I'm wondering, I mean, you know, anything about politics, it's all a game of optics, how things are perceived. And it was kind of like he was backhandedly honoring these veterans, these Navajo code talkers, with a portrait of Andrew Jackson looming over them. And, you know, the grace and dignity to which these veterans handled that situation was amazing. But to not understand the history behind that man, behind Andrew Jackson, to not understand the genocide for which he's responsible for, and, you know, the stealing of land and the stealing of homes, the stealing of lives, I mean, it's appalling. And to hear politicians, to hear the President of the United States and others in his party praise him, it baffles me, along with everything else going on in the country right now. It absolutely baffles my mind that you can, you know, sing the praises of a man who governed over such a dark time in our country. It's the same way why I don't understand why people praise Christopher Columbus. It's the same concept. I don't get it. I mean, these men were not great, and I think that's one thing that we do in history is we try to, you know, sugarcoat it, and I don't sugarcoat it, and I don't feel like I need to, because I feel like the history speaks for itself, and the history says Andrew Jackson was not a good man. So it really hurts my heart, it hurts my spirit when I hear people sing his praises.
Understandable.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the Trump administration and looking at Native American activism today, there are a few things that the administration has proposed and some things that they have set in motion that really do harken back to this long history of struggle, really, with United States policies. What are some of the things that have come up in, you know, the last couple of years that activists are really fighting against?
Well, again, I think first and foremost at the front lines is the stopping of pipelines. When we thought we had a small victory during the Obama administration when he halted the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline and basically Keystone Pipeline as well, and then Trump is elected and he comes into office and he immediately signs those into work, all in the name of progress and in creating jobs, not fully understanding, or probably in his case, not caring that he actually destroying land and destroying sacred, you know, burial sites. The Dakota Access Pipeline goes straight through some burial grounds, you know, that are important and sacred to the Standing Rock tribe and the other Sioux and Lakota tribes in the area. But they're important. They might not be land that belong to them, you know, through treaties, but I mean, they are lands that are important. So first and foremost, the stocking of pipelines, the protection of our water, not just for Native people, but for all people. Here in Michigan, we have our own issues with water, with our Flint water crisis, with Line 5 going through the Straits of Mackinac. There's water shutoffs in Detroit. Our students in Detroit public schools don't have clean drinking water right now, because they just found lead in their water, just like they did during the Flint water crisis. So water, of course, is first and foremost the protection of our Mother Earth. Another issue that I know that has come up within Native communities is also the issue with our missing and murdered Indigenous women. There are no statistics that are held on us, so we don't know how many are missing and gone and never to be found again. And that, I think, comes with how complicated investigating crimes on reservations can be. It's so intricate and so complicated on because we're reservations are technically under federal jurisdiction. So do you call the state police? Do you call the local police? Do you call the FBI? Or do people even care that, you know, our Native women are going missing? Another issue is I just read not that long ago that the Trump administration, one of the things that they want to do is they want to, so we're classified as sovereign nations, and that's how we're recognized to the U.S. government, but they want to reclassify us as a race as opposed to sovereignty, and that affects funds that we get for health care for our tribes, for our nations, for our people. A lot of people, a lot of our elders, you know, rely on those health care benefits that they get from the government, and if they reclassify, you know, Native Americans, that affects that as well. Another issue that's going on that just came up, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, which is the tribe that you learn about during the first Thanksgiving, they actually just lost some land that was supposed to be put in federal trust for them. So they were already in the process of developing this land. They were going to create a new casino, I believe a museum, some educational areas as well. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is under the Department of the Interior, took that land away. So now there's a fight for that because if it's a possibility that the federal government can take land away from one tribe, they can eventually end up taking it away from all of us. That threatens our sovereignty. I mean, there are so many issues that I think that people aren't aware of that happen in Native country that are equally as important to the issues that are happening to the general population right now.
Yeah. Well, Heather Briegel, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and thank you for sharing your work.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me. You know, anytime I can share our history or a little bit of what's going on in our community, I'm always up for that.
Heather Briegel is a historian and lecturer who was in Milwaukee in October for the lunch and lecture series at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke with Joy Powers then.
Growing Power went under last year, and now urban farmer Will Allen has reinvented himself. Well, sort of. Lake Effect learns more in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Will Allen, founder of the Milwaukee-based Growing Power, was heralded as a guru of urban agriculture. His reputation grew far beyond Milwaukee. In 2008, the MacArthur Foundation awarded him a $500,000 genius grant for, quote, transforming the cultivation, production, and delivery of healthy foods to underserved urban populations through a novel synthesis of low-cost farming technologies.
After nearly a quarter century, the nonprofit shuttered its doors last November. But in the years since, Allen has returned, this time as a for-profit farmer on the same three-acre urban farm on West Silver Spring. Last month, Lake Effect's Susan Bentz visited him inside Will's Roadside Farms and Markets. Its greenhouse is brimming with herbs and vegetables, including eggplant and okra. Allen shared some thoughts about Growing Power's legacy and his plans for the future.
This is probably the only place you could get some okra in the state of Wisconsin, unless you're growing it in a greenhouse. So.
And what's this beautiful blossom here I see?
That's where the okra actually comes from, that flower.
Beautiful. Yeah. So what else you got going?
We've got oregano, a lot of herbs, sage, thyme, basil. We've got a lot of sorrel that goes into our salad mix.
You've got a customer base that continues. You're doing a CSA that's going to go year-round?
Yeah, we've always done this market basket since 1995 when I started it. So,
at the point that you decided to go or were encouraged to go nonprofit, what went into that decision at that time?
Well, I had some friends that, because I was working with kids in the neighborhood here, and, you know, this is a neighborhood that's a food desert, and at that time, unemployment was very high. I mean, it's still high in the inner city. regardless of what the national or state numbers say. So I started hiring kids and working with kids, and you know, my friend said you should turn this into a nonprofit. I didn't know anything about nonprofits, so I said at that time, well, if you guys want to be the board and raise money, you know, because my whole thing is I'm a farmer, I want to do the work, I want to do the training of folks in the community and that sort of thing. So that's how we launched this thing back then.
It's incredible, really, when you think of all of the school groups. In fact, I heard that you had a school group that came through today.
Yes. Yeah, so school groups are calling, companies are calling to come and volunteer and help, and individuals, of course. So, you know, it's not like the 150 employees, because we were a pretty major employer of people in the inner city for a long time. You know, how many companies can you think of that are hiring 150 people and paying them really well? So, but that's always been my goal, is to make sure people had a living wage and so forth. So, and it, you know, as I started to get older and raising money, doing trainings, writing a book, traveling, doing 60 trips a year around the country, around the world, you know, it kind of wears on you, you know, a little bit.
So when you think over that era, what do you look back and say, you know, that was something, or that's one of the things that it was really important, or an experience I thought I'd never have?
Well, I think I never planned this to, you know, have so many people coming here, but we were getting 30,000 people here a year and training people and launching people into businesses was something that was very satisfying. Probably the most satisfying piece was to have these young people in our youth corps going to college, staying with us from 8 years old through high school, and now they're doing well in life. And, you know, so that was probably the most satisfying piece. The innovative pieces that I came up with was just things that, it was like putting a puzzle together. I call it a food system puzzle, where you had to have, you know, you start with the soil. So growing soil was really important. And to be able to grow the food and to be able to teach people how to harvest and how to get that food into the community was really important. Healthy food that was missing in the community. And really inspiring people. I think that's the best thing we kind of do also, is to inspire people to go into this urban agriculture piece that's growing all over the nation now. As a matter of fact, there are social entrepreneurs that will be coming into this town that want to set up businesses to help the community. So, you know, that's something I'm working on now with folks.
So you've described farming as an art form.
Absolutely. Especially if you're doing sustainable agriculture, you're not using chemicals. It's really an art form that you have to learn how to do. You don't learn how to do it overnight. So it takes a lot of patience. And people aren't necessarily passionate about doing it. They like it. They think they're passionate, but they're really not. You have to have patience to grow your passion. I wish I could grow passion like I grow cucumbers or lettuce or something, but it takes time. And young people that I talk to, they want to get into this, but only maybe 1 out of 100 actually will sustain themselves and stay in it. It's like 5 years and they're out. Because what typically happens is they graduate college and they start a business growing food in the city or outside of the city, and after about 5 years they look around and see their peers making six-figure salaries and they're making 20 grand a year. And they want to start a family or whatever, and they can't do it on that 20,000 a year. So there's a lot of things that they have to deal with to want to stay in this business. It can't be about the dollars. That's a key thing. Because everybody's always looking at the dollars, you know. I'm gonna make a lot of money doing it.
So I hear water flowing behind you. I see. Do you have fish?
Yes.
And you do have fish?
Yes. That's
so the perch are going?
Yeah, the perch are going. I was able to save the perch. I had a partner, and we had a business in Indiana, and those perch were brought up here from Indiana. So those are our brood stock, our breeding fish. So they're like 3.5 years old, and we'll be breeding those fish this spring.
A ribbon running through your story here has been the aquaponics and working so closely with the School of Freshwater Sciences with Fred Binkowski.
Yeah, Fred is a wonderful person, a wonderful friend, and just probably the smartest guy I've ever worked with in terms of his field. He pretty much created a lot of stuff that they're doing around perch and, you know, working with other species as well. So our relationship has been over 10 years now, and we're going to continue to work together and train people. We've trained over 500 people from around the world here and at the university in our aquaponics training. So that's been something that's very valuable for the whole, really for the whole country, because we need to start raising our own fish here in this country and not be so dependent on China. China has a large portion of the production of or the sale of fish around the world. So we need to get back into the business. The only way to do it is to learn how to grow a healthy product, because these fish have no mercury in their, they're healthy fish, so you could eat them every day. Whereas the stuff in our rivers and streams and the oceans, of course, they're polluted, and you can't, there are limits on how much you can eat, and there are limits on, because we've overfished a lot of places, and we've set up situations like in the Great Lakes where certain species just don't survive anymore because it's a sports fisherman's paradise, these Great Lakes. And that's cool, I mean, you know. But back in the day, you could do sports fishing, and you could also,
sustain.
Ma and Pa could go out in a boat and catch some healthy fish, but that's no longer the case.
So really, Will, your mission remains the same? You're just back to being profit rather than nonprofit?
Yeah, we started the first 2 years as a for-profit. And
back in the 90s.
Yeah, and really, I've always said this, that nonprofits weren't really meant to do this urban agriculture in terms of sustaining themselves forever, because it's one thing for nonprofits to train people how to grow, especially kids, and that's what we have mostly. But to try to run an organization just on selling the product that they're growing is very difficult, because you need a lot of production. 99% of the food is shipped into this city that we eat. And most people still eat in from grocery stores. I mean, let's face the facts that most people eat from grocery stores still.
You owned this farm long before you sold it to the nonprofit. Is that how it worked? So how important is it to maintain this as a farm?
Oh, this is a historic building built in the late 1920s. It's very important for us to maintain this. This used to be all greenhouses in this area. And this is the last piece of that era. It's a culturally significant place that we have to make sure it stays. It doesn't mean that we can't build other buildings on the site, because it's 3 acres, but these 6 greenhouses, A-frame greenhouses, should stay the same. And that's what my purpose is, to make sure that happens as long as I'm around.
So how are you going to do that?
Well, I think it's up to the community. It's not necessarily up to me, but to make sure we educate the community around why this is so important. Because after I'm gone, somebody's got to do it. But as a for-profit, I think that for-profit businesses are important from the standpoint that anytime you have a for-profit, you have to put some skin in the game. If you put some skin in the game, then you're going to stick around. But if you don't have any skin in the game, you can always walk away. So I think that's the difference between a for-profit and a non-profit piece. You know, and most non-profits have other initiatives they're working on. It could be art, it could be farming, is just one of maybe 10 things that they're involved in. So I think it's important that these entrepreneurs do this. So I'm working with a lot of young entrepreneurs who are interested in aquaponics. As a matter of fact, one group wants to grow sturgeon here in the city. They met with me. I told them, I said, the first thing you got to learn how to do is how to do aquaponics. They want to do it aquaponically on a pretty large scale. They've got their eye on a building to be able to do it, and they would bring the Russian sturgeon in for caviar, of course, you know. But they first have to learn how to grow a fish. So that's what I'm teaching them, how to grow, about aquaponics, how it works. And
we're getting a little in the weeds here, but how old does a sturgeon have to be producing the eggs, the caviar? Because those get to be obviously humongous fish.
Yeah, they're all different types of sturgeon.
Okay.
And I don't know that much about sturgeon, to tell you the truth. They're very smart young people, so they can take it from there once they learn. But I convince them that they first need to learn how to grow a fish. You know, you don't want to make this huge investment without knowing a lot about how to keep a fish alive, because it's much harder than keeping a plant alive.
So it sounds to me, Will, as though you are doing much of everything you did in the past. I mean, you're training, you're nurturing entrepreneurs, you've got school groups coming in, you've got a year-round food basket program going. So as you came back in after recuperating, are there things you're not going to do that you did before?
Yeah, I'm not going to scale this up to the point that we're hiring a lot of people, because a farm like this doesn't require as many people as we had as a nonprofit. We were doing, one year we did 70 different projects. I'm not going to do 70 projects, you know. What I'd like to do is pass on my knowledge to anybody who wants to learn how to grow food. Now, the latest thing, of course, is hemp, because we're one of the states that you can grow hemp. So I'm teaching people how to grow hemp, and how to turn that into CBD oil. And there's a lot to learn about that, because you have to do it in very good soil, because it's a remediation type plant. It takes up whatever's in the soil. So if you have bad soil, it's going to take it up into the product, and you wouldn't want to give that product to anybody. So there's a lot to know about growing hemp. And our whole thing is about wellness. So that's just another piece of the puzzle to help people get well and stay well.
How does the foodscape, the food desert that we hear about so much, how is that factoring into your, how you're spending your energy?
You know, to alleviate hunger and grow and have folks eat healthy food is one of my number one priority. I mean, I got a lot of priorities, but I just told you.
Let's make that clear.
But that's a really important priority, because one of the things about, all you have to do is go to one of the hospitals around, and you see so many people that are devastated by being overweight, diabetes, especially in communities of color. And when I was in the hospital, I saw that. When I go to the doctor's office, I see that. And it's heartbreaking to see so many people not living, not going to survive as long as they could survive, because, you know, when you look at even the Western Hemisphere here, we're number three in life expectancy. You have Canada, we have Cuba, and we're number three. That shouldn't be that way if we're able to get healthy food into people's bodies and give them, have them have the right kind of exercise and so forth. So my work with the First Lady, Michelle Obama, was really important in the list.
I'm so glad you mentioned her.
Yeah, I was able to, of course, help her with the garden and help her travel with her to Europe, and her huge commitment to the Let's Move project has really helped. You know, it really brought a lot of people of color into understanding that they have to start eating better, because she was such a great spokesperson for that movement, you know. So that was one of the most satisfying pieces of the work that I was able to do over the years.
Well, your legacy, I mean, your work continues, you've got lots of head, but it, as you look now back a little bit, is there anything that you would change, that you wouldn't do, that you did do?
Oh yeah, there's so many things that, now that I look back on it, you can't be too far ahead of everybody else. Even though you're a visionary, sometimes you have to kind of shut down your visionary ideas. You don't want to do that, but, you know, toward the end of growing power, I just kind of shut down my ideas because I had to try to hope that people would catch up, you know, and it was out of my control. But as a for-profit, it is in my control, you know. So that was probably one of the things that I didn't think about, because I'm a very trusting person, and I trusted a lot of people that, you know, sometimes you can't trust everybody, I've been told.
So do you allow yourself a little downtime these days, or is there no time for that?
Well, to tell the truth, I really haven't taken any time off since January. I work every day. I don't physically just go out like I used to, because I just can't. You know, I always used to brag that I could do the work of five people, but I'm probably down to a half a person now.
Well, I don't know about the average person, but
you know, but that's one of my things I have to improve on. You know, how you have these things that in life that you just need help with, you know, and that's one of the things that I need to do is learn how to relax, because you become more efficient if you're more rested and take some time off. So that's something but I had to get in here and get this straightened out, because it was kind of a mess, you know. It doesn't take but a couple months before a place like this just falls apart. But now when you walk in, it's kind of back to the way it was. Yeah.
Will Allen was the founder of Growing Power, the iconic nonprofit disbanded last November. Currently, he operates Will's Roadside Farms and Markets out of the urban farm site on West Silver Spring with a small cluster of volunteers. You can read more about his work and see photos Susan took during her recent visit with Will Allen at WUWM.com.
We will take one more break now and then get an update from Milwaukee's Pabst Mansion. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are remarkable buildings and spaces around the city that people can visit year-round. One of those is the Pabst Mansion. It's one of Milwaukee's prime examples of the Gilded Age, and it stood here for more than a century.
Construction on the mansion began in 1890, and after it left the Pabst family, it became the Milwaukee Archbishop's residence. It's been on the National Register of Historic Places since 1975, and this year marks its 40th anniversary of being open to the public.
Pamela Williams-Lyme became the new president of the Pabst Mansion this past summer, and John Eastberg is its executive director. I sat down with them earlier this year in Captain Pabst's study on the mansion's first floor. Williams-Lyme explained what brought her to the job.
Well, I'd been to the Pabst Mansion many times, and the mansion itself, once you have an opportunity to come in and experience, really draws you back for multiple times. And this opportunity was presented to me to become part of the team to help it continue moving forward and building it into the landscape of the city of Milwaukee, even further than it's come over the past 30 years.
What do you see as some of your biggest challenges starting out as someone who knows the place, you know, somebody who's visited it, but now someone who's really in charge of making sure that it remains here for decades to come?
Sure. I think we've done a really good job, and we're on the path to complete restoration of the home and retaining and gaining more of the original artifacts back to the house. We've collected a number of archives that we've been working on. So the next step is really building a sustainability path for the organization, which will include becoming a bigger resource through lending our archives to other researchers around the country and beyond. And then completing that restoration project, possibly doing a build out to better meet the needs of the community and the activities, be it educational, research, as an organization for the community.
So when you say build out, do you mean literal build out, like adding on into the property somewhere?
Those are considerations being entertained at the moment. What that looks like, we don't know yet, But we do feel that the Pabst Mansion, you know, has a historical presence in the city of Milwaukee, but how we operate and what we offer as a resource to the community is somewhat limited based on the space that the house has to offer.
Now, John, you've been part of this for how long now?
Next month will be 25 years.
So what brought you here?
A flyer.
It was really that simple?
It literally was a flyer at Cardinal Stritch College when I was there my last semester. There was a flyer to volunteer at the Pabst Mansion. Of course, I had an interest in historic architecture, history, and this was just going to be something that was going to get a little job experience.
And here you are.
And here I am.
25 years later. Pamela was talking about the restoration that's continuing, that's ongoing. Have you been in charge of that pretty much along the way?
Pretty much. Real interest of mine was using these original 1897 photographs we have of the house to not only bring the interiors back to what they look like, but actually to start populating the rooms back with original objects. And I think for people who might have seen the Pabst Mansion 10, 15 years ago, even 5 years ago, the Pabst Mansion has completely developed into another institution as far as the aesthetics and the art collection. I mean, I think that's kind of one of the best kept secrets in Milwaukee is the sublime art collection that we have, hundreds of pieces of which actually were collected by the Pabst family. So these are things that left the house in 1907 when they closed up the house and it was sold to the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, have remained with the Pabst family, but over the last 10, 15 years, they have donated hundreds of objects back to us. So they're excited for people to see the house the way their ancestors saw the house, and they're so supportive of it becoming kind of its best self.
Where are the branches of the Pabst family at this point? Are they all around the area or have they gone much farther?
They're all over the world, you know, and there still are a couple of branches that are here in Wisconsin and southeastern Wisconsin. But a lot of the branches over the generations, you know, kind of moved either to California or New England. One branch ended up back in Germany shortly after the turn of the century. So they really are all over the place. And last summer we had the 125th anniversary of the completion of the house and had a all-branch Pabst family reunion. So we had over 80 family members come back to Milwaukee.
Were they impressed?
They were very impressed. They were very impressed with the house. They were very impressed with Milwaukee. We kind of showed them the best of the city, and they could see where the Pabst Mansion fits into that. And I think it's things like that that fuel their interest in seeing the Pabst Mansion continue to thrive, support it, but also to bring original artifacts back. And quite frankly, I think they sometimes challenge one another. Well, I'll give this, but you have to give yours back over as well. And we're putting together a collection of three paintings in the dining room that were separated to three different branches in 1907. We have two of them back in the house, and we're working on the third right now.
So, Pamela, I know you said you've, of course, visited here many years before you assumed your current position. Do you have a favorite place that you like to come back to within the house over and over again?
You know, each time I come back to the house, I look at it with a different pair of eyes. So, you know, the first time you come in, you're just trying to take in the whole house. The second time you come in, you start noticing the details of the structure. The third time you come in, you might focus on strictly the artwork. So every time you come in, you absorb something else and you get more excited about something else. So to answer your question, I don't have a specific favorite room necessarily, but each time I come in, I identify a different detail that really speaks to me.
Again, there's so much to look at, and mm-hmm. And I'm sitting facing the door, and I'm assuming this is a closet. The door is gorgeous, but what keeps drawing my eye are the hinges.
The hinges are remarkable, and the store that we're looking at was Captain Pabst's records closet, but also his cigar humidor. So he consumed about $21 worth of cigars a month in the 1890s. That's so we have his cash book, so it's kind of interesting to see what he was spending money on in those days. And that was a lot of money, you know, for cigars. But yeah, this was all done by the Matthews brothers here in Milwaukee. They were like one of the best woodworking firms in the Midwest. It's funny to think of that they bridged this house, and one of their last commissions was Falling Water. in Pennsylvania. So it's just very funny to think
very
of.
Different.
Yeah, very different. You know, styles do change. And but, you know, this is an extraordinary house. Again, hard to believe that was built in 2 years.
2 years, and that it almost became a parking lot.
It almost became a parking lot. So it was, you know, West Wisconsin Avenue, then known as Grand Avenue in the 1890s, had about 50 or 60 mansions lining it. And through development, most of those mansions were gone by the 1970s. And when this house came up for sale, really the only person that had the wherewithal to purchase it was the gentleman who owned a hotel next door, and his intention was to tear it down for a parking lot.
So Pamela, what do you see as some of the first things that you want to accomplish as president?
You know, Milwaukee is such a thriving city and there's so much energy, and I think that there's great opportunity with partnering with other institutions to make the Pabst more visible for all the resources that we could provide to the community. I think that that is a real focal point for the organization as we look forward to generating more support to get some of those other projects done. I think that it really does speak to the history of the city, and we have some huge opportunity with education, you know, developing a relationship with the school systems to become part of the local education and history of the city of Milwaukee. So I'd have to say it is going to be reaching out with to many different partners for a lot of different things as we carve that path for the future.
I also would think that there would be room to keep it on the curriculum for the schools of architecture that are mm-hmm. around. Do you get students in from those schools just seeing what people were doing in the 1890s?
We do on a regular basis with MIAD and with UWM School of Architecture. It's so interesting because this house is really a feast for the eyes when you're used to modern architecture. You know, it is kind of overwhelming in some respects, but it's interesting to see the students really get into the craftsmanship. And a young person in their teens and early 20s, they've never seen kind of these really designed, dense, rich environments. So it's fun for them to just kind of dissect a panel, a wall, and then they think of how that panel was crafted and you know, it's a detail house. And so I think it, as a learning tool, I think it's just amazing. I love when we get thank you notes from younger students and what they see here, which is so fascinating because I don't think it's anything the three of us would see, but they see details and they make their own connections. And I know that the Pabst Mansion and the experience they have here will definitely resonate with them going forward.
Well, one of the things that is so key, as you say, for people who are used to a much more, or much less, maybe, is a better way to put it, a type of architecture where things are much more streamlined, there's very little detail, you know, colors aren't like on top of each other necessarily. You walk into one of the rooms and there's so much layering of texture and color and contrast, and you realize that can all work together too. We're just not used to seeing it
right
now.
And to be fair to the Pabst family and the late Victorians, you know, they were finally starting to understand how to make all of these things work. And I always think this house is that earliest, you know, what would be one of the earliest results of using interior designer and having a son-in-law who was an artist who was put in charge of the interior and making sure that everything harmonized and was cohesive.
Thinking about color.
Yeah, no, and because I think they saw in the 1860s and 70s just how wacky these interiors could get with all their colors and patterns. And this house is definitely, I know to our modern eyes, it doesn't seem like an early 20th century house, but it's definitely moving in a direction. and you can see it. You know, it's the first floor, it's fairly open concept with the pocket doors. It really is a very light, inviting house, including all the wrought iron and antlers that are around. But it's definitely moving into the 20th century. It was a very modern house for its day.
And it is a tool for future design influences. When you look at students coming out of school, you know, what influences their creative design going forward as they pursue their careers going forward. And this is really a great impetus to, you know, having that influence impact what they're going to do in their futures.
Right. Who knows what little piece of something that they see becomes a motif in their own work.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, we encourage having students come to us for sort of an interface relationship, whether that's an internship, if they want to volunteer here, or just for touring. There's a lot that can be taken away from the house itself and its design features.
So before I wrap up, I wanted to ask you, John, in the 25 years you've been here, what thing surprised you the most that you discovered about this house or something in this house?
That there's always something more to see about the Pabst Mansion. And that's truth. Because I've always come into this house with fresh eyes. And to Pamela's point, you just do always see something new. And it's extraordinary when you think of coming to the same place, essentially, almost every working day for 25 years.
I have to say the thing that surprised me the most was the fact that he was a wine drinker more than a beer drinker.
It's our little secret. We won't tell anybody.
Okay. So. No, a secret safe with
us.
Yes.
He had an interest in a winery in Germany and would bring barrels of wine over here and decant them in his cellar. And he had over 3,400 bottles of German wine laid in at one point.
Wow.
So
none of that's still here.
None of that, unfortunately.
The Archdiocese, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not.
They took care of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those inventory documents have not surfaced yet. So
maybe they will.
Yes, they will.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for taking a little time out of your day to show me around and also talk to me about the Pabst Mansion. And Pamela, best of luck setting out on your new job. I'm looking forward to seeing what you do.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Bonnie.
John Eastberg is executive director, and Pamela Williams-Lime is president of the Pabst Mansion. We spoke with them from the mansion, which is located at 20th and Wisconsin on Milwaukee's Near West Side. You can find a link to information about the building and how to visit at wuwm.com. And that is all for today's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be along with us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.